Hello and what is up, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we are doing our April Q&A episode here in May because of technical difficulties. While I was out on the road, if you tuned in to our last podcast, which was released back on May 7th, you are aware that I had carved out a little bit of time while I was in St. Louis almost a little over a week and a half ago now to get this episode done. And after recording, trying to transfer it, get it edited, and somehow, some way, shape, or form, the file had been corrupted. I wasn't able to transfer it and unfortunately did not have enough time to re-record and do everything all over again. So here we are doing it now for you. And we've got a boatload of questions to dive into coming fresh off of an amazing trip out to the Midwest and touring around the great state of Missouri. Before we get into it, quick announcements as usual. Number one, follow us on our social networks. You know the drill, at MTGA Wines on Instagram, YouTube, The Book of Face, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Be sure to head to our website, mtgawines.com. That's where you can find out a little bit more about us, our wines, join our newsletter, wine club, what have you. You can also scroll down on the homepage there at mtgawines.com. There's a little email form so you can submit your own questions here to our monthly Q&A episode, which typically comes out on the last Wednesday of every month. Last and certainly not least, we are in the midst of our spring release. We've got Chenin Blanc, we've got Rosé, a Pinot Noir, and a Red Blend that all came out. So while you're on our website there, be sure to check out our shop, see what we have available. That is for those that, of course, are 21 years of age or older, because underage drinking is bad. Don't do that. Don't do that. Okay, let's dive into this, shall we? Our Q&A episodes are always a ton of fun, and especially when we have a plethora of events and people that we're hanging out with and chatting with over the course of a week. And a lot of these questions today are coming from some of those events while I was out in Missouri, both out in Columbia. Big shout out to the Country Club of Missouri and all of our friends that we saw there. Also, everyone we met in Springfield, St. Louis, and of course, everyone at Shuttlecork out in Kansas City. It was a really amazing time. So a lot of these will kind of tie into some of those events and just kind of other stuff that we have going on around the growing season and as we're progressing further into the 2025 year, season, harvest, right around the corner. Believe it or not, it's coming down the pipeline. So the first question here, this really ties into actually kind of the travel and some of the events and the things that we do. So we'll go ahead and just start right here. Question number one, I'll remember to timestamp these so I don't have to listen to the sound of my own voice as much while I'm editing this damn thing. All right. When you are planning a wine dinner, how do you decide on what is served? Does the venue slash chef collaborate with you, or you just each serve what you feel like? And this is, man, we've done both, to be honest. And the latter is really not all of that ideal. There's an event actually last year where this happened, where it wasn't set up really to kind of what is my standard, not to be too snooty about it. But very typically, I like being able to have a good phone call, at least, if not a Zoom or something, or be there in person to help, you know, pair up our wines with the food that's going to be served. Very, very typically, I will send wines out in advance to the chef or to the venue and say, hey, open these up with your team, try them, and figure out what you are going to pair with them. Shooting from the hip just typically doesn't work. This event that we did last year was a great wine dinner, actually just outside of Kansas City. Everyone had a great time. Like, the food was good, but it conflicted with the wine. And almost like some of you have probably had this, where it's like someone, you serve a red wine with like a fish or something, and it's like, well, it just doesn't, like, it overpowers it and you can't really taste the dish. Or maybe you're doing like a dry red wine with dessert and you're like, ooh, it gets like really acidic and tannic and you can't really taste all the red wine. The dessert's really good, but it overpowers the wine. So you can end up kind of with, you know, things at odds, basically. So, the Country Club of Missouri, while we were out there, a big shout out to their chef, Rachel, for helping dial all this in and tasting the wines ahead of time and getting the food set up and ready to go, because it was one of, quite literally, two of the best wine dinners I've had in recent memory have been in the great state of Missouri. This was one of them. It was just outstanding food pairings, killer work, very well executed, very well done. And at the end of a four-course meal with a bunch of wine, we left very happy, but not like overly full or too hammered, I don't think. It was like the perfect blend of just like getting everything done and everyone having, I think, a great time. And that doesn't happen without a little bit of collaboration. It really does not. You know, it's a little bit tough for me just to, expense-wise, just to fly out just to make sure the wines are going to work. But sending some samples ahead of time, allowing their team to taste through everything, kind of wrap their heads around like where these pairings are, kind of the potential behind them and what can be done is just outstanding. We had all kinds of great conversations about this meal. And there were some things on that were a little potentially going to cause some issues. We had a lot of greenery, which can make wines a little bit austere. Amazing fresh like asparagus, you know, which is killer during the springtime. And when you're pairing that up with a little bit of pasta but with a red wine, you're like, ooh, that greenness might translate to the red wine side of things. In fact, there'd probably be many winemakers, especially from out here in Napa, that would say, hey, there's not meant to be anything green, bitter, or anything anywhere near the dishes that we're serving with our red wines because we're afraid that it's going to just completely blow up the wine and you're not going to have this great complement to the wine and as a result, not a great complement to the food either. And I'm one of those people where even though I do want to collaborate and kind of have my opinion and make sure that folks get to try the wines, I do trust them. You know, if you're a good chef and you know a thing or two about how to cook a great dish and, you know, how to pair it up with wine, I'm going to let you run with it. You know, I'm not necessarily going to step into your kitchen and tell you exactly like, hey, this is what you need to cook. Do it this way or don't do it at all. That's not how I operate. You know, I will always give suggestions. In fact, when we are kind of coming up with this menu for this event in particular, and we do this for many, many events, is I give kind of like the basic pairings. And, you know, like here's the stuff that we have found has worked. Here's kind of some of the classic pairings that we use. Here's some of the oddballs that have worked as well. If you wanted to be a little more creative, like please, like have at it and, you know, try to kind of, you know, run with it a little bit. Like, don't be afraid to be creative and kind of put your signature touch on it as a chef, but please don't destroy the wine in the process. So luckily, this is a lot like dealing with our grape growers and trying to get great produce so we can make great wine. When we are working with a chef to collaborate and create a wine dinner, we both want our food and the wine to look good, taste good, and for everybody to enjoy it. So it's a very synergistic relationship. It's very easy. There have only been like a handful of times where I've had to like critique a menu or I've had to ask a question and be like, so what do you mean by this exactly? I think one of them, this would have been in Atlanta maybe 2 years ago, going on a year and a half ago maybe, where it was like a lobster cheesecake or something like that. It was something super weird. And I saw the menu like the day before we were supposed to go to the event, and luckily we were hanging out with someone who worked at the venue, and we were like, so what is this exactly? Like, is this supposed to be like a really fucked up dessert, or is this like more of like a savory, you know, like palate cleanser? No idea what was going on. And had a quick conversation with Chef. He's like, oh, no, trust me. Like, with the white wines you guys are serving, I tried them. This is great. Just kind of, you'll believe it when you see it. And I'm like, okay, fine. We'll see what happens. And sure enough, we get there. We tried it. And it was lights out. It made no sense having a lobster, like, infused, like, cheesecake thing, like, whatever it was. It was super weird, but super delicious. And it worked great with the white wines we were serving. Because we were doing it with another winery and some friends of ours as well. It was great. So there are moments like that where you just kind of have to let people do their thing. And it's like, all right, prove me wrong, because that sounds super jacked up. But let's see how you do. You know what I mean? Let's see how you do. It can be challenging because chefs can have, you know, chips on their shoulders sometimes. And, you know, they don't want to be told how to cook in their kitchen, just like winemakers don't want to be told how to make our wine or what we need to be doing on our side of things. So I get it. You want to be protective of your space and kind of what you're trying to achieve. But you don't want to go too far. You don't want to be too creative. You don't want to push the boundaries too much. So yeah. So when we're deciding on wine pairings and dinners and stuff like that, it's typically very collaborative. It's rare that we try to go too crazy, but we don't, shy away from a little bit of experimentation, like here or there. All right, question number two. All right, how is the anti-alcohol movement continuing to gain ground? So it's actually funny that this comes up because I feel like more and more, and this is probably just my algorithm and social media and everything, because the only social media I really pay attention to is our business accounts. I don't pay any attention to my personal stuff. I canceled my personal Instagram, Twitter. I have the Facebook page because you have to have a Facebook page to operate your Instagram page, but I'm never on there. I hate social media kind of just as a general rule. It's nice for business and marketing purposes, but for me personally, I'd spend too much time doom scrolling, so I got to try and like stay off of it. Long story longer, I've seen a lot more positive, a lot more positive vibes around the alcohol industry and kind of what's happening right now than I have in a while. And I think it's officially just kind of the pushback from the industry and people within hospitality and wine and the alcohol industry in general, trying to figure out where did this all of a sudden, all this stuff come from? I mean, because you have everything from like your fitness, like influencer types to your, kind of health or like biohacking people jumping on this train. You have certain studies that have been done or conducted and like special panels that have been created at like a governmental level for some of this stuff. And an example of that, and I'll have a link to this article. This was an article done on Wine Searcher not that long ago by W. Blake Gray regarding prohibitionists still writing alcohol rules, which is very much a thing. And this is kind of some stuff that I'm learning as a part of this. And some of you may remember from an episode back in January, we talked about kind of this pro-prohibitionist kind of movement and the HHS coming out and saying, hey, any and all alcohol is bad for you, no exceptions. And what we're finding out now is that there's an organization, I guess, or a committee or something called this is all in the article, by the way, so you can fact check me if you want, called the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. And it is required by Congress to provide guidance on the dietary guidelines regarding alcohol. So they have a bureaucratic, body that is, in essence, kind of providing recommendations. And this is kind of the way it's been. Apparently, what had happened under the Biden administration, not to get political, but this is just how it happened. He had an interagency coordinating committee on the prevention of underage drinking, another giant fucking acronym that you can't hardly keep up with, that had an appointed 6-person committee to produce its own report. So another committee was created because, hey, let's just double down on bureaucracy and, have at it. The panel had addiction specialists, an epidemiologist, and anesthesiologist, and a generic, quote, scientist, they say. And apparently this was funded by a group that was attempting to get young women to drink less, which, fine. Like, if you're going to want to combat underage drinking, I have no problem with that. Technically, I think us human beings, like, our brains are fully developed somewhere between the age of, 24 and, 28, maybe. That range might be wrong, but it's somewhere in there. And realistically, consuming anything that's like brain altering, whether it's drugs or alcohol, is not recommended during those developmental years. So totally get it. I definitely started drinking when I was a lot younger than I should have been. I joke that, I had my first sips of wine when I was around 2, which is absolutely true. I wasn't getting hammered at 2, of course. I'm not Stewie from Family Guy here. But wine was a part of everyday life. We tried wine regularly. We didn't drink it regularly. We would have sips of it, things of that nature. You weren't getting hammered, right? Then, of course, that kind of changed through high school and college. And so I still think that, to the probably the point of this, organization is they're a little bit more of that prohibitionist side. I'm more of the, let's educate people and kind of, dismantle the taboo surrounding alcohol when you're young, a little bit more like Europe, where it's a part of everyday life and people understand it, that it's an indulgence and something that should be done and consumed in moderation. And let's remember, all things in moderation, including maybe moderation every once in a while. Anyway, off my soapbox I go. This other agency was one of, or this other committee or whatever it was one of them that recommended that, hey, any level of drinking alcohol is bad for you, which of course is what Health and Human Services reported at the very beginning of this year. It turns out that this other panel that was created under the Biden administration, and it states this here in the article, that it specializes in alcohol, or it does not specialize in alcohol. It's actually more focused on tobacco. And it announced at a trade meeting that was now like the lead author of alcohol dietary guidelines. And that's been confirmed by several people, apparently in different alcohol trade organizations. And it's like, okay, so now you have people that are kind of ruling on something that they don't really know anything about. And we're just kind of pushing everybody towards this prohibitionist thing. Now, you combine that with the power of social media and how things kind of spread through the interweb these days. I mean, hell, even Joe Rogan came out over the last couple of weeks and said, hey, like, I've stopped drinking alcohol and I don't know why I used to do it. For someone that, I'm paraphrasing here, but in his post is like, I'm someone that works out and tries to take care of himself. I'm like, I don't understand why I've been, you know, drinking this stuff that's not technically good for me in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, maybe that's fine. You know, if you decide that alcohol is no longer serving you in your life, like, totally get it. Like, I'm not going to sit here and, like, try and college age, like, frat boy peer pressure you into taking a shot with me. Like, that's not how we're going to operate. But I find it hard pressed to believe that, you know, any amount of alcohol is bad for you, period. Is overdoing it bad for you? Yeah, sure. But overdoing anything, eating too much fucking cake is bad for you. So let's be real here. It also, you know, the original organization, again, that National Academies of Science, Engineering, Medicine, the one that actually is supposed to be reporting to Congress, concluded that while binge drinking and alcoholism are dangerous, go figure, right? Let's have some common sense here. Moderate drinking reduces all-cause mortality. In other words, your overall risk of death. Moderate drinking does raise the risk of certain cancers, in particular breast cancer, but it also reduces the risk of dying from heart attack and stroke, and heart disease remains the leading cause of death in the U.S. So, you know, devil you don't. You know, if you are hyper worried about cancer, breast cancer in particular, my mother is a breast cancer survivor, so I get it. She still enjoys a glass of wine nightly, if not maybe two nightly. And is, you know, this is something that we work with. My grandmother, same thing, loved her Kettle One and loved a good glass of wine from time to time. Also in the later stages of her life had cancer. This can be genetic and hereditary. Maybe this is caused by alcohol. I don't know. The thing that, you know, of course, grinded my gears about this back in that original episode that we posted in January was that there was no actual causation shown. It was all correlation, and there were no actual, like, hard point data, like numbers to back any of this up. Now, again, I don't think anyone's going to argue that, you know, alcoholism and binge drinking are bad. Like, probably tone it down a notch, but you can do this kind of stuff in moderation, and that's just fine. But you also have to decide, maybe like a Joe Rogan or somebody who's been consuming it for a long time, you know, is it actually serving you? Is this something that you feel as though enhances your life, or is it detracting from your life? You know, if you're waking up hungover as shit, you know, 5 days a week, that's probably where you need to start dialing back. Shoot, I've had those moments where I'm like, you know what? I've tied it on a couple of days in a row because of events and wine dinners and things of that nature. I need to, like, slow down. I need to go to the gym. I'm going to drink more water, more electrolytes, kind of put myself in a position of recovering a little bit. And, like, back off and, like, step off the gas for a little bit. Again, moderation, people. It's not hard. So the anti-alcohol movement, like, continuing to gain ground, it's largely just because there's a lot of stuff being thrown at us. And in this 24-hour news cycle that we live in, or less for that matter, I mean, it moves at such a fast pace, you know, it's tough to keep up with what's right, what's wrong. And I the thing that still, again, kind of grinds my gears, it's like, it's not that long ago that, like, eggs were supposed to be super bad for you and margarine was super good for you compared to, like, real butter, that fat was bad for you, right? It's like there have been things, you know, from our government, you know, regulation, like the food pyramid's like a total joke in terms of what you should really, really be consuming. And this is stuff that's been shoved down our throats for years. And I think now there are people now more and more that are a little bit more skeptical about being told like, hey, this is what you should be doing. When in fact, we all need to decide for ourselves. I know full well that when I eat certain things, I don't feel that great afterwards. I might love a cheeseburger, but I know after 2 hours, I'm going to need to take a nap because it's just, it's a huge piece of bread and meat and all the toppings and fixings. And you better believe I had some fries with that bad boy. And I am done after having that. Like flying back to California a week ago, and for one of my first stops was In-N-Out for a couple of cheeseburgers and some fries. And I got to tell you, the nap after that was outstanding. But I knew full well going into that, that by the time I decided to, you know, my body started digesting all that stuff, that it was going to slow down and I was not going to be feeling too hot. But I know that because I've done that before. I've been there. Where if I have something that is, frankly, a little cleaner, more vegetables, less bread, a little bit more protein, whether that's from an animal source or otherwise, I typically feel better, lighter, more refreshed, things of that nature. And that just comes with getting to know yourself. So again, this is a little bit of a soapbox that I'm standing on to answer this question, but I'm trying to convince folks, you know, just pay attention to yourself and decide what's good for you, despite kind of what the noise around you is saying. And if something in your life is truly not serving you anymore, whether it's alcohol or anything else, maybe it's time to reevaluate your relationship with it and decide if it is actually something that benefits you. And this is coming from a winemaker who makes a living producing an alcohol product for people to enjoy. You know, again, I said it at, you know, some point in the last couple of minutes, I'm not going to frat boy peer pressure you into having a drink with me. What I hope you will do is sit down and have a conversation, and with any of these folks, especially when it appears that there's a lot of other risk factors that wine or alcohol in general can help decrease. Now, is there a net negative? Yet to be seen. Is there a net positive? Yet to be seen. I think there is a lot of gray area here. There's a lot of nuance based on who you are, your genetic makeup, what you eat, how much you exercise, all this other stuff, right? So that all needs to be taken into account. And that's what's crazy about this anti-alcohol movement is like none of that stuff has been. Nothing genetic, no external risk factors, no lifestyle choices. Like none of that was taken into account in some of the research that was presented at the beginning of the year. So it boggles my mind that this continues to kind of gain ground and be a conversation point. But you are now starting to see the pushback of people being like, hey, there's a whole nother organization that disagrees with you. And there's a lot of evidence that disagrees with you. While there are certain risks with all things, maybe there is a net positive to be had, or at least a net neutral. And maybe the net negative is not nearly as severe as we think. And it could be vice versa. But let me put it this way. I'll kind of finish with this one point, is that this is a little bit of a tangent, but shoot, a few weeks ago, I bought a new pair of gardening gloves. I'm like, you know what? The springtime is coming around. I've got plenty of yard work to do. Let's buy some new gloves. And I shit you not, the pair of gloves that I bought had a cancer exposure warning on them. And I'm like, okay, at a certain point, like, what are we even doing here? So I think that there's a lot of this has gone way too far. Obviously, I'm biased. I'm in the alcohol industry. But it's clear to me that at a certain point, there are other external forces at play here. And frankly, if you want a glass of wine, then drink a glass of wine. If you don't want to drink because you don't like it, then don't. You're an adult. Make adult decisions. All right, that's me getting off my soapbox for a minute. Okay, let's dive into question number 3, shall we? So how is business in Napa at the moment? Slow. Man, it's slow. This was one of the questions from our wine dinner at the Country Club of Missouri, one of the first questions that we kind of dove into. And it's tourism is just down. You know, what's interesting is even over the last couple of weeks, we've had a lot of wineries calling friends of ours and who like own tour companies and concierges. And they're like, hey, like we have a pretty open calendar. If you have anybody that you want to bring by for a tasting or an event or anything, let us know. And a lot of these referral sources are like, yeah, we don't have anybody. You know, people just aren't coming, you know, to the Valley like they used to. And I typically agree with that. I think there are a lot of big names and kind of tourist trap type places that are kind of scraping up a lot of the folks, everyone from maybe a particular castle winery that we've mentioned in a couple of episodes, or are there just big names that are kind of like pulling on a lot of the tourism here? It doesn't help that Napa County has been incredibly adversarial in this whole process and is really not allowing us small producers to do what is needed for us to kind of survive and do what we need to do as a small wine business. It's amazing how anti-wine Napa County is and how anti-tourism Napa County is. It's really quite amazing. So business right now is rocky. You know, it's one of those things where we've talked a lot about kind of the contraction of the wine industry and sales and how they've dipped, you know, especially as we kind of wrapped up 2024 and saw what the damage actually was. You know, even a brand like ours, we were down a very clean 10% over 2023. That being said, 2023 was one of the best years we had ever had. However, you know, things have gotten a lot more expensive in terms of our cost of doing business. So being down that much was not great. It really, really kind of sucked. The good news is that there was a decent amount of bounce back for brands like ours and for many others through the latter half of 2024. And it seems as though it's like 50-50 right now. You have brands that are either really, really struggling right now, or you have some that are kind of like scraping by. And we're luckily in the camp that we are scraping by. We've had a pretty good start to the year and things are not nearly back to where we hope them to be or hope that they get to, but at least we're not dead yet. That's kind of the mentality, is that if you can survive this, you should be just fine. So, you know, if you're really worried about some of the small producers that you love to support, now's a good time to buy some wine for the summer months and, you know, do what you can. You know, and many of you have done that. For those of you that have been on our mailing list or in our wine club, many of you are continuing to do that, which is a huge thank you to all of you guys for being supporters. You're the ones that make us small wine businesses, you know, or at least give us small wine businesses the ability to do what we do. And there are a lot of them out there, smaller wine businesses that are just unfortunately not doing too hot. And maybe they're riding off into the sunset. They kind of see this as the writing on the wall and they're just kind of naturally wrapping things up, as sometimes that does come to pass, which is unfortunate for some of things. But we'll see. You know, I'm still cautiously optimistic that we'll see, you know, a good pickup through the summer and into the fall, which is always, you know, the fall season is always our busiest time of year, whether it's for tourism or, of course, the harvest season. And we should be okay. You know, we should be okay. I think this correction is, in fact, just that. It's a correction. I don't think the industry is imploding in any way, shape, or form. Every time I'm on the road or talking to people, they're excited about wine. They're interested in wine. You see people trading up for a great quality wine. They'll gladly pay more for a few less bottles as long as they know they're getting a higher quality product. And I think Napa is a perfect, you know, candidate for that, where, yeah, you're going to have to spend a little bit more, but you know that very typically the quality that you're going to get is going to exceed what you paid for that bottle. So I think there are some producers out here, and we hope to be one of them, that not just make, that doesn't just make great wine, but provides amazing value to you, the consumer. I think that's where this reset is happening, is people are looking for not just good quality, but great value on top of that quality. And that has been really tough to find over the last probably 5 or 6 years. And now we're starting to see that kind of reset and people trying to figure out, you know, hey, how can we kind of jump on this train and focus on value and not just spare no expense quality? Because those two things don't necessarily go in hand, especially when it comes to an art form like wine. And I, believe me, I'm one of those people that believes wine is an art form. It is something that you can't just manufacture and hope to sell buckets and buckets of it. That's not how it works. There are a lot of people making a lot of good wine out here. You're going to need something else that provides value in some way, shape, or form. And there are a lot of wine businesses right now that aren't providing good value, bar none. Okay, let's get into question number four. I think we got time for at least one more question. We'll see if we can't squeeze in a fifth here. Question number four. Another question actually from our Country Club of Missouri dinner while we were out there. This is a great one actually, especially considering that we're getting into like the thick of the growing season here. Are organic / biodynamic farming methods really worth the effort? Does it make a difference in the wine and make a wine more natural? So, I mean, this, I guess, is a little bit of a tough one to answer, but does it make it more natural? Sure. I mean, you're creating, you're letting the, you're kind of creating a more of a natural ecosystem. Let's break down these two farming methods first, because you have basically like four segments to farming. There's a little more than this, but I'm going to try and like simplify it down a little bit. You have your normal conventional farming, which is what we've been doing for like corn, soy, like all the mass produced stuff. It's, yeah, we will use tractors. Yeah, we might spray with, you know, pesticides, herbicides and things. We'll do what's needed for the best of the farm. Maybe if we don't need to spray, we won't, but we're not afraid to, right? That's kind of conventional farming. It's not really a regenerative process. We're just trying to get as much produce as we can. You have sustainable farming, which is not organic, because you're still trying to create more of that regenerative process now. You don't want to necessarily use herbicides, pesticides, things of that nature, but you're not ruling them out depending on what you have in front of you. I mean, very luckily enough, there's a lot of organic sprays and other things that can be utilized now. The technology has gotten a lot better. So, you know, can you just say sustainable and run with it? I think so. It's not something that scares me. Do I need like a vineyard to be certified organic? No, I don't. Quite frankly, the organic certification is very expensive. It's not necessarily like worth it to get that like stamp and seal of approval, in my opinion. It's a great marketing tool, but you can certainly practice organic farming and not have to get the certification. And that's a lot of the growers that we work with, as a matter of fact. Some have transitioned or are going for that certification or have that certification. Good on them. It's not necessary. This really comes down to, you know, the relationship with the grower, what you know about that vineyard and how they are operating and whether or not you trust them as a business partner, basically. So, you know, organic farming is great. The certification, you know, if you're truly worried about, you know, buying stuff of, you know, what you think is going to be less manipulated, especially when it gets to the seller. I mean, maybe that makes sense. But even then, organic doesn't necessarily mean less manipulation. I should also mention that just because you farm organically does not mean that you're creating an organic wine. And the big hiccup there, when if you're trying to get a certified organic wine, is the addition of sulfites. If you're adding sulfites, typically that excludes you from being a certified organic wine, for example. So there might be, I don't know, I haven't looked into the process or the certification in a long, long time, so I might be wrong here. There might be some kind of threshold that you can use, but to my knowledge, you're not supposed to add any, period, to your wines as an additive. So just because you farm organically doesn't mean that that wine is technically quote-unquote certified organic either. So there's like a difference to be made there. Now, biodynamic farming is probably the most extreme of the bunch because, yeah, and people, there's so many strong opinions about biodynamic farming for no good reason. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Listen, because it's the reason that it's people, I remember getting to one argument after another about this when it was becoming more and more popular, especially in the mid-2010s. And, you know, people rag on biodynamic farming because it does rely on phases of the moon and certain types of days. You have your typically your, I think, fruit days, leaf days, and like root days, or whatever it is. And based on what phase of the moon is in and what type of day it is, that is when you do certain things. Now, admittedly, that's voodoo. For all of you that believe in horoscopes, yes, you believe in voodoo. Because my favorite question always to ask is like, so does your horoscope account for the fact that all these constellations have moved quite a bit over time? And the answer is no. So, but if that makes you feel better about why you're having a bad day or a bad month, more power to you. You know, let Mercury, blame it on Mercury. That's fine. You do whatever you got to do, okay? And the same thing kind of goes for that aspect of biodynamic farming. Now, the reason why biodynamic farming is kind of buzzy and exciting is because, or a couple things. One is that realistically, like the manures and things that you're creating and the ecosystem that you're providing for the vineyard is all good things. Like, it's not like this is a bad idea. You know, there's a lot of great things that come out of biodynamic farming, organic farming, that really can benefit your natural ecosystem and be regenerative and help provide really high quality produce to make wine out of. That's a good thing. Whether or not you buy into the phases of the moon and all that other stuff, you know, that's up to you, okay? Like, fine. You can take that with a grain of salt, or you can use that as like the Bible if you wanted to. I'm not going to sit here and judge you. you know, if you want to go out and dance naked in the vineyard because you think it makes your wine better, I mean, fucking have at it. Like, I'm not going to judge. But the reason, like, biodynamic farming got really popular, and this is kind of the undercurrent of what I found out, you know, working in the industry. And again, this is kind of this is an opinion. This isn't necessarily, you know, exactly how it happened, but as phylloxera was rolling through Europe in particular, and in France, they started, in certain areas, they started poisoning their soil with copper sulfate, if I remember correctly. And it was to try to kill phylloxera, which, for those of you that don't know, is this little pest that feeds on the root system of the vines, and eventually they callus over and it kills off the vine because they can't absorb any nutrients, things of that nature. So, terrible thing. They tried everything from flooding their vineyards on a regular basis to spraying. They tried, you know, this copper sulfate stuff. And we finally found out, it's like, oh, we can just use an American rootstock and graft our vines onto this, you know, our European vines onto this rootstock, because the European rootstocks had a natural resistance to this pest. And we're right as rain. Took a lot of time to figure that out, but we got there eventually. Right. The problem was a lot of places had poisoned their soils and had depleted them or destroyed them in some way, shape or form because of what they were doing to try and mitigate this pest. And a lot of it was quite literally just poisoning the land that they were using. So particularly in certain, you know, areas that were using those methods, biodynamic farming was a huge boon because they were able to start kind of regenerating a healthy ecosystem in their soil. Like, that is shown, as far as I know, that has worked. So, you know, that's a good thing. You know, again, I can't argue, you know, is a biodynamic wine better than an organic wine, better than a sustainable wine? Like, I don't know. That up for debate. You know, I think that there's a lot of these things. There's a lot of gray area in between each and every one of these. Whether or not you get certain certifications is totally up to you. You know, if you are really trying to focus on, like, supporting farmers and vineyards and wineries that are trying to do right by the land, then yeah, maybe you look for some of these certifications, or at least you ask, like, the right questions. You know, knowing that, like, for example, that we work with growers that, you know, in essence, practice organic farming, but they don't want to have to pay, you know, arm and a leg for the certification. Like, maybe that's important to you. As far as I know, actually, none of the vineyards we've sourced from are biodynamic. Not that I would be for that or oppose it. It's just like, all right, cool. That's a great, man, that's a lot of extra work and it's expensive to do. And hopefully the fruit turns out better. I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. Up for debate. None of these things, however, to the second part of the question, will make a wine, quote, more natural. As you all know, you can go back to my natural wine episode if you haven't heard it just yet, and you can listen to about why natural wine is dumb and is a huge problem, because it actually kind of works against what they're trying to do in terms of making a wine, like, quote, better for you. Comes down to, like, yeast selection, right? Because there's 1% or less of the yeast that's, like, naturally occurring out in the vineyard is actually stuff you want to use. That is fact. That's how it is. So you either have a really healthy, natural, like, microbiome that conducts really great fermentations for you, or it gets really funky really quick and actually creates more compounds that are prone to causing headaches and creating more issues with you, the person consuming it. So if you're consuming natural wine, you're getting more flush, you're getting more headaches. There's a pretty good reason for that, because it's backed up in the science. You can go read the natural wine article on winefolly.com. They've posted stuff about it. You can also go back and listen to that episode about natural wine that we posted, I think, a couple years ago now. You might have to scroll down a little bit on our YouTube channel or through our podcast feed to find it, but it's worth a listen if you're really interested in natural wine and what my opinion of it is, because it's not necessarily better for you. It's just not. In fact, sometimes, maybe more often than not, it's technically worse based on the compounds in it. How about that now? That we can actually measure. Okay, we're right up against it. I think that about covers it. Thank you all for your patience in getting this April Q&A episode out in May. We got two episodes that came out this week to try and play a little bit of catch up after our technical difficulties on the road. So luckily I am home. The travels are over for the foreseeable future. We should have an episode a week coming your way, no problem, for most of the summer. Very excited to continue covering some of these topics. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. That is YouTube, Instagram, Book of Face, as well as a social network formerly known as Twitter. You can slide into our DMs on any of those networks and submit questions for this Q&A. You can also go to our website, mtgawines.com, not only to find out a little bit more about us, but also scroll down on that homepage. There's a little email form that you can fill out and send questions our way as well. Those of you on our mailing list that follow us on our social networks, be sure to keep an eye out for our spring releases for you and our wine club. That's already happened. You guys got it because you always get first dibs on everything. And for everybody else that might not be a part of that, you will be receiving those updates this week and into next week as well. Have an excellent rest of your day, week, month, whatever the case may be. And we will see you next time here on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.